Welcome to the VA Tourism Podcast, and I'm Coach Bentham Williams. The VA Tourism Podcast is dedicated to Africa's travel and tourism industry, where leaders from the private and public sectors get to talk to us. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Podcasts. In this episode, my guest, Chris Fling, President and CEO of the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage, discusses in detail the impact of COVID-19 on the culture and heritage sectors and advises destinations to make them core pillars as tourism restarts.
Hi, Chris Fling. Good morning and welcome to the VA Tourism Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Great to be with you, Kojo, and thanks very much indeed for inviting me to be part of this today.
Okay, excellent. Now, let's just get into our conversation. Tell us more about the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage, and if you can give a background to it, of course, yourself, you know, etc. Yeah. And again, I mean, yesterday was a World Tourism Day, but then we come that we progress the conversation on the line. So if you can give me an overview of what the association stand for and the modus operandi.
Sure. I'm going to take you a little bit further back to how I got involved in cultural heritage and why this has been so important for me. So culture and heritage and this whole idea of getting close to, you know, sort of international communities has been with me from a very early age. I'm actually a musician, and as a 15-year-old teenager, I was invited to go to Italy. I'd never been anywhere before in the world ever, and I was so excited. So 15 years old, and I get flown to Rome, and my first ever international performance was on a 2,000-year-old Roman amphitheater stage, and it completely blew my mind. I was planning to go and do a fine arts degree in the UK, but I made my mind up right there and then, Kojo, on that stage, that I was going to travel for the rest of my life, which is what I've done. And so this whole idea of being close to culture and having some kind of connection to a country has been very important to me. So moving rapidly forward to my previous role before the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage, I was the regional director for the Pacific for PATA, the Pacific Asia Travel Association. And I did that role for around 15 years. So the area that I focused on was the Pacific itself. I had 22 countries that I managed, but I was also required to travel internationally, literally all over the globe. And I would speak at different conferences, international events, usually about 2 a month. And one of the things that I was recognized for was the fact that my research and my ability to look at future trends and turn those trends into strategies was something that I'd like to think that I have a good reputation for. Anyway, I was invited by the Chinese government to visit a place called Guindannong, which is on the western side of China, very remote area. And they flew me there to have a look at some of the very old cultural aspects of that particular region. And they were there to ask me, or they wanted me to be there to show them or to talk to them about how to develop their cultural heritage assets and to do it in a way that was going to protect and preserve these assets, because they understood that they'd made some mistakes on the eastern side of the Chinese sort of tourism offerings. So I was quite interested in that because, you know, the Chinese don't necessarily do anything for nothing. There's always a reason for it. So I began to research as to some of the aspects of cultural heritage tourism in China and within the Asian region, because of course we were focused on Asia Pacific. What became very apparent was the main reason that they were looking at the development of cultural heritage tourism and to do it right was because of the expectation for millennials traveling in the future. Now, we know very well that what we call the gray nomads, you know, the baby boomers, the people who look like me, you know, when they travel, they might spend a bit more time, they want to have a more immersive experience in these different destinations. But millennials was something that wasn't really on the radar to a large degree. So what my research found was that consistently both from an Eastern mindset, from a Western mindset, and from a global mindset. The number one thing that millennial travelers wanted to do was to have a true, authentic cultural experience. And from a Western mindset, on all the surveys that we had, when you actually consolidate them, about 84% of all surveyed millennials wanted to have this experience. When you look at the Eastern mindset, the Asian mindset, it was about 74, 76%. So this was huge. And what became very apparent was that we were expecting 100 million millennials traveling over a five-year period pre-COVID-19. And when I looked at the checks and balances that were in place by the leadership organizations of the world, my own organization included, PATA, there weren't any protections. When I began to study this, it began to become very apparent that the industry had been allowed to grow, you know, without any of these checks and balances. And this had resulted in the erosion of culture. It had resulted in the damage of critical and sacred assets. It had resulted in destinations who saw tourism as being a way to grow their economy, being ill-prepared to welcome tourists. And a great example of that is an amazing destination of Easter Island, Rapa Nui, which is the local name. Now, this is an island that is 3,500 kilometers away from the nearest landmass, Chile, that own Easter Island. It has a population of 7,000 people, or just over. In 2018, they welcomed 106,000 tourists to this tiny little island. Of course, initially it was good for the economy, but what suddenly they realized was they were now having to manage 20 tons of garbage every day. How do you get rid of garbage when you're on an island 3,500 miles away from anywhere? You have to burn it.
Yes.
Anything that was recyclable, you know, plastic, was flown out to Chile every day. And having 100,000 plus visitors and only 7,000 population meant they couldn't manage the sacred sites that they were from their traditional beliefs. So this created a series of abuses from local from visitors. So Instagram photographs with the giant Moai statues. You know, I won't go into what those photographs look like, but I'll leave that to your imagination. There were some sites that were damaged. There was one site in particular that was damaged by a vehicle that crashed into it. And this thing is gone now forever. It can't be rebuilt. So when I started to look at all of these particular issues, I raised these with the various different leaders around the world. Okay, what is the plan? What are we going to do? If we don't have these checks and balances in place, and looking particularly at the Eastern mindset, the Chinese mindset in particular, where they always want to go one better than somebody else. It's just the way that they are. If I go to Paris, someone will go to Rome. If I go to a remote island in the Pacific, someone will find a different, more remote tribe somewhere else. So this became a real issue. And I couldn't get any traction. I couldn't get any traction from UNESCO or anybody else. So I came to the conclusion that something had to be done. And if anyone was going to do it, there was very few people around the world that had my network, that had my experience and my background. So I quit. And in 2018, I launched the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage. And the first thing that I did was I worked with the University of Queensland, two very well-known professors from cultural heritage. And we delivered and built the codes of conduct and ethical standards that our industry should follow. And we created these in a language and in a way that the industry can follow them. Because as you're probably aware, the vast majority of reports or principles that we are guided upon tend to be, you know, maybe 96 pages thick. And our industry just doesn't have the time or the inclination to actually follow them. They have to be concise, they have to be simple, but they have to ensure that we cover all aspects of the industry, both from the custodians of the asset or the local communities, from the tour operators, from the international operators, and everybody else involved, including government. So So that's how we were formed. That was the reason why we were formed. And you might not believe this, but what completely blew me away, and I've got nearly 40 years in tourism here, is there was no global organization on the planet dedicated to the protection and preservation of cultural heritage assets through responsible tourism practices. Everybody had just assumed it had existed, or just thought UNESCO should be doing this.
Because I was going to come there, yeah.
Right? And of course, that's not their mandate. That's not their mandate at all. They're not in tourism. So we'll come on to that a little bit later. So
interesting. I mean, that's quite a journey, you know, looking at your own personal journey and then being an inspiration towards an important stakeholder like the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage. Now, where do you operate? You know, and it will lead me to the question of whether you have Africa as part of your stakeholders, and where there's a plan to be engaged with Africa as well.
Yeah, sure. Again, so we're unlike probably any other association, and that's because of my background in associations. Okay. So we do things a little bit different, and we do it differently simply because we want to ensure that the cause of the organization and what we actually set out, our mission and our vision, are the key things that we stick by. I'll come on to that a bit later. So before I launched the organization, the two things that I did was to form the Code of Conduct and Ethical Standards. The second one was to build a team of global experts and people who have particular skills and networks within particular environments. So one of the things that became very apparent again was that there were some linkages that were missing. From tourism, when we look at education, we tend to look at universities or training schools that focus on tourism, which is fine. But from a cultural heritage aspect, there was no linkages with the cultural heritage sort of academia or academic side of things. And within the own association for culture and heritage, from an academic perspective, there's almost 3,000 people contained within the membership of that organization with no tourism linkages at all. So think about all the research that is being done, that is sitting on shelves, that is not being shared with the tourism community. So the first thing, that was one of the first things that I did, is I created a link with academia so that we could gain knowledge from some of the studies and some of the reports that were being done worldwide. I then brought in different members of the team. So for example, one of my team members is a Professor Thomas Bauer. He's a German guy. I've known Thomas for many, many years. He's an expert on environment and sustainability. And he wrote the tourism sustainability plan for Antarctica. So you don't get much bigger than that. And what I've done is I've pieced together different members of the team that have different skill sets, but that combine to ensure that when we work with destinations, when we work with tourism stakeholders, when it comes to driving policy change, when it comes to dovetailing with other organizations, international or local, that we have a team member or a group of team players involved that allow us to do that at the highest level. So if you go onto our website, which is wtach.org, you will see the depth of knowledge that we have. Between us, we have more than 400 years of experience at the most senior level of tourism. So we automatically take off 15 years of our experience and build that up. So that is the level of expertise that you have if you engage with the organization. To come on to your second question about the engagement with Africa, we have a representative in Africa, a lovely lady called Florence Nkini, which is based in Tanzania. And Florence reached out to us probably almost a year or so ago. And she was concerned about some of the damage that was being done to some of the cultural sites in Tanzania, and asked if she could work with us and get involved with us to try and assist her on her mission to protect these assets. What we've done since with Florence is we've basically invested time with her to expand our reach into Africa. And just over the last maybe 3 or 4 weeks, we've had conversations with Rwanda, with Kenya, Nigeria, Zambia, and our, in case you're not aware, but our head of strategy, the gentleman called Sean Vorster, and he's actually from South Africa. So South Africa has tremendous potential from a cultural heritage asset for all different reasons. In fact, I posted something today on LinkedIn about Ghana and about the year of return in 2019. But when you look at the depth of history within Africa, it's very misunderstood. I'm very passionate about ancient history, very ancient history. And when you look at the very ancient history of Africa, and you look at African people in the South American continent, pre-Inca and pre-Aztec, and you look at all this kind of stuff that's out there, there's so much to learn about the continent, and there's so much opportunity about developing this. The thing about it is, it has to be done right. If you don't do it right, it will be exploited. Local communities won't benefit. Conditions won't improve. And basically, things will either remain the same or go worse. So again, one of the reasons we established the organization was to work with destinations and to guide them on how best to develop their cultural heritage tourism offerings, experiences, in a way that protects, preserves, and builds pride in local communities whilst improving their economic conditions.
Okay. Now, obviously, we are in unprecedented times, and I refer to COVID. And from your perspective, and realizing that culture and heritage, in most cases, it's found in the rural destinations or the less urban cities. What are you envisaging in terms of the culture and heritage of destinations in this period? Because I also remember that most of these destinations and attractions survive because of tourism in its general perspective. What can we do to be able to at least withstand some of these shocks like COVID and other natural or artificial occurrences?
COVID-19, the silver lining to COVID-19 is the fact that we have an opportunity now to take a breath, take a step back, and to analyze and look at what we've been doing, how we have been either successful or not, what has been successful, what are the things that need to be considered if we are going to move forward in a responsible and sustainable way. Most destinations, to a large degree, because we have just been on this trajectory for so long, have basically been making it up. And everything has been focused on volume, not quality. Even UNWTO, when they, don't get me wrong, I'm not criticizing UNWTO. This is the way it's always been done. These are the measurements that have always been there. But even in 2019, it was a great year because we grew by 4%. But we saw incredible challenges around the world. We saw millions of people, in Venice. We saw Santorini. We saw Croatia, Iceland. All these over-tourism issues, Thailand, etc. It wasn't good for that destination. So there has never been a focus on quality. And what we can do now is we can sit back and we can start to look at what kind of a tourist we want to attract. Now, two things have happened here. One is already with the research that's being conducted, we know for a fact that the mindset of the traveler globally has changed. Whereas it was easy to jump on a plane and go to a destination, whether if I was in the UK, I'd go to Spain or Italy or whatever, and it would only cost me a few pounds. That's going to change. So with COVID-19, there'll be a progression of how people open up to the world. So domestic tourism will be first, regional tourism will come second, then there'll be people will go further afield. Long haul is quite some way away, because people are not going to jump on a plane and travel 24 hours if there's a risk that they may get stuck somewhere in a destination. So that's going to take some time to come back. So whilst this consumer mindset has changed and this traveler mindset has changed, one of the things that we know, is that they're going to be traveling less, but they're going to want to experience more. And what they're going to want to experience is this word again, this authenticity. They understand the quality of travel now. They understand what the opportunities are in terms of immersing themselves in real experiences. And this comes a little bit off the back of what was found with Airbnb. When Airbnb launched, they found that people weren't necessarily staying in the downtown hotel areas or key areas. They were staying in suburbs of cities and different areas because people wanted to get closer to community. And this is going to be encouraged. This is going to happen more and more as we start to transition and regenerate out of COVID-19. So culture and heritage, history, ancestry will play a huge part in what people will be seeking to do in the future. And you know, when I looked at, just mentioned UNWTO with, you know, 4% growth and in 2019 and 1.5 billion travelers around the world. Well, it was estimated by UNWTO that year that 47% of all travelers have some form of cultural heritage experience when they travel. That means that in 2019 alone, there were over 750 million people traveling the world seeking to have a cultural heritage experience. That has to be a massive opportunity if you do it right.
Okay, no, that's excellent. Now, if you want to link it to, of course, I know by your name, World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage. What is your role to help also preserve this same culture?
Sure. So again, each destination is unique, as we know. The reason we put the team together, and the team, as I say, we have this 400 years of expertise, is so that we can work with destinations to build a responsible and sustainable cultural heritage tourism plan. It has to sit at the side of your tourism plan, but connect with your tourism plan, if you will. But there are various different things that you can do and things that you need to do immediately. So with destinations that we're already working with, the key thing that we usually do is do what's called a carrying capacity study. Now, a carrying capacity study is where we determine just how many travelers you can take before you break, for want of a better word. And again, this whole idea of over-tourism was basically due to destinations not really understanding how many visitors they could take before things completely got out of hand. Now, this might be a country, it might be a city, it might be a region, it might be a village. It could be a whole range of different things. But if you have a small rural community that has some kind of historic or ancestral links or has something unique, do you really want to have a million tourists a year paying nothing? Or do you want to have a few tourists a year who really want to visit that place, who are willing to pay handsomely for the privilege? Because travel is a privilege, and I think people will respect that more and more post COVID-19. So understanding how many visitors you can actually take to a country, region, city, or place is very important. Another study that we tend to do is where we look at what's called a revenue capture study. And what tends to happen, particularly in emerging destinations, and particularly in areas where we have cultural or tribal opportunities or assets, is that operators from around the world, international operators, will come in, they'll see the opportunity, and they will promote these destinations. But you will find that the vast majority of revenues earned will not stay in the country. They will go back to the origin of the operator's country. And this happens all the time. So looking at a revenue capture study and understanding how you can keep more of the revenue that is generated within a community, particularly in the hands of that community, is also incredibly important. Because what happens then is communities begin to understand the positive aspects of tourism. They begin to understand the uniqueness of who they are, they begin to understand then or realize the pride in who they are. And in the work that I've done in the past, this has been very sort of prevalent in places like Papua New Guinea, where you have these remote tribes in the highlands of Papua New Guinea that have, they are literally Stone Age people. They are tens of thousands of years old. You know, Papua New Guinea has 3/4 of the world's languages. So some of these people have never seen different cultures before or different people stepping in. So going in and training them, educating them on how to run a tourism practice that sustains who they are, that builds pride in who they are, builds pride in that community, and pride in their traditional beliefs and ancestry is incredibly important. So these are the kind of work, this is the kind of work that we do. And we don't just go in and write a report and leave you with it. We ensure that part of that report means that we do the training, we do the education, we hold your hand. And if we have to be there for 5 years to do that, we'll do that. Because you only get one chance at this. If you mess it up, there's no going back. Because once culture is gone, it's gone. Once it becomes extinct, it's finished.
We have to get it right. And I believe you read reports recently about how some sites are in danger because of COVID and also climate change. I think about 10 or 15 of them on BBC reported on that story. But how do we then make destinations aware or help them to build back well with culture, heritage, and then, like you said, if we take a breath and then we are going forward, what are our recommendations to these destinations to make culture and heritage, you know, inherent part of their own strategy?
What I'm hoping is being realized, particularly from COVID-19, is when we looked at how tourism was expanding and the rate that it was expanding prior to COVID-19. We live basically, Kojo, in an homogenized society. So if I'm in London, it's almost, some of the streets almost look the same as they do in Sydney or New York or whatever. The only thing that separates a country or a people from anywhere else in the world is culture. It's the only thing that is unique to any destination. And it needs to be the foundation, because in the future, culture means everything. It's not just bricks and mortar. It's not just the pyramids or the Parthenon or the Colosseum. It's the community. It's the people themselves. It's that kind of invisible skin we all wear that tells people who we are, where we came from, what our origin is. And these are the things that need to be celebrated in the future. So to answer your question, there's many different issues. I posted recently on social media, possibly the report that you mentioned, where climate change was having a very detrimental effect on many of the African cultural heritage sites. But there was only 1% of global research being conducted into the protection and preservation of cultural heritage sites in Africa, which when you think about it, is insane. You know, there's thousands and thousands of cultural heritage, ancient cultural heritage sites in the continent. 1% is a disgrace, quite frankly. So again, it comes back to working with a destination. It has to have a whole of government approach. What's happened pre-COVID-19 is that you will have a national tourism organization that is responsible for marketing the destination. And that is to grow the numbers and the volume of tourists and visitors coming to that country and building the economy around it. They're not responsible to understand whether you have all the right infrastructure in place, whether the road systems are fine, whether you have enough parking bays for your coaches, or whether you have enough, you know, bandwidth for your Wi-Fi. The work that we've done in different destinations so far is we work with government. So first of all, we work with tourism, the National Tourism Organization, and we work with industry stakeholders. But usually in the initial meetings that we have, we bring in other government departments, Department of Infrastructure, Department of Telecommunications, Department of Water, Department, all the different things, because these are critical aspects to growing tourism moving forward. We're also bringing local community, because what tends to happen, and I've seen this over many, many years, is a consultant will go into a destination, he will write a tourism strategy report. Rarely, if ever, I've seen any time they've had dialogue with local communities. So there'll be a bunch of KPIs that will fall out of that report, but there'll be no conversation prior to that to understand the capacity of what the local people, the local community, the local tourism industry has to deliver on those KPIs. So if they can't deliver them, because these are just fundamental KPIs that are general across the board, if there's no understanding of what the capacity is for a destination to deliver on that, it's useless. So the approach that we take is that we bring community in at the very, very first meeting, so that we get the feedback from the community. What do they want? You cannot, or you should not, impose your will on community. They have to be a part of the solution, and we have, and they also help us identify what the problems are. So by doing this, what tends to happen is we spread the responsibility of tourism growth in a responsible way between government departments. We then do it through tourism ministry and stakeholders, and we bring into those arguments community, because they're the people who actually are going to be the face of your culture moving forward. And by doing it that way, what tends to happen is we create an emotional connection, because the strategy that we develop comes from the recommendations of the people and the key stakeholders in the room. We just basically put that into words and into strategy through the expertise that we have. But it has that local community and that local area at its heart. I must always have it at its heart, otherwise it'll never work.
Okay. And my final question is how do travelers or tourists contribute to the preservation of culture and heritage? Because sometimes I realize that people take trips and not doing the basics of understanding the particular destination, their cultures and you know, the history of it, and then they then tend to do things that may either offend the culture or, you know, in conflict to what, you know, their people believe in.
We see this more and more. This has been going on for quite a long time. And again, when you're dealing with a volume sort of matrix in terms of success as opposed to quality, you're always going to have these issues. So again, just last week, there was a guy arrested in Rome for carving his name into the pillars of the Colosseum. You now see graffiti in the tombs of Egypt, which are Chinese, Mandarin. We see all sorts of abuses taking place, even like the ones I mentioned from Rapa Nui, Easter Island, with the Moai statues. This comes down to a number of different things. First of all, the destinations have to be better prepared for this. So there's many different ways that you can educate people. One of the best ways to do it is actually on the airplane. You know, you can work in conjunction with an airline so that, you know, as you're doing your arrival briefing on video on the airplane, you ensure that the belief systems and the sacred sites and what is important to a local community are understood by the people getting off the plane. So part of it is education. You're never going to stop ignorance. There's always going to be ignorant people out there.
Yes,
people
who don't care, sure.
Okay. You're never going to change that. But there's different ways and mechanisms, particularly through your distribution systems, whether that's a wholesaler, whether it's a travel agent, whether it's the airline, whether it's on board the airline, whether it's in the literature that you give the people when they actually book, or however it is. But what we would do, again, it comes down to working with a destination, identifying what the problems are. They're different and unique depending on which country it is. It could be an environmental thing, it could be a whole range of different things. So we would work with developing a communication strategy that targets the traveler, that targets the visitor, and ensuring also things like signage, things like various different protections, security. You know, there are destinations which I won't mention who are world famous around the world that have no security, that have these sites completely open at night, that creates litter, that creates abuse, vandalism, all these different things, some by the local community, some by visitors. So again, it's about education, it's about security, and it's about making or driving awareness of just how, you know, whether it's a sacred site, a fragile site, whatever that is, getting the traveler, the visitor, to understand as part of the experience what that is. And that comes down to these ethical standards and codes of conduct, which I mentioned earlier. These were the first things that we created. So they already exist. It's a case of basically building those into whatever strategy we develop with a destination.
So Chris, as we wrap up, any final words for the tourism community or, you know, the global? Yesterday was World Tourism Day, Tourism and Rural Development, and culture and heritage, you know, cannot be more significant in that theme than that. What would be your final words?
What I would say is right now is you have an opportunity to develop your cultural heritage tourism like never before because of COVID-19. You have to ensure that you do it right because you only get one chance to do this. And that is why WETAC, as we're called, was established. Whatever you do, you must have community at the center of everything that you do. You cannot impose your will on people, nor should you. They should be part of the opportunity, part of the solution, and part of the strategy moving forward. If you start to build those fundamentals into your planning, you will be successful because that becomes responsible tourism. And because the people who you've involved, the local communities that you've involved, the custodians of the experiences, the destination, the various different assets, belief systems, whatever they are the custodians of this. They are the people that own it. If you task them to be the people who deliver it, to be the face of your opportunity moving forward and train them accordingly, then you'll be very successful moving forward. And you will ensure that what you are trying to promote is protected, that in terms of could be a fixed asset, is preserved, that could be a belief system, a language, and it'll be treasured by local community and will build pride in that local community as well as improving their economic standing. So that is really the way I would say to different destinations and stakeholders around the world, and particularly in Africa, this is your chance. Grab it with both hands and move forward with it. Because when we start moving again, we don't want to go back. We want to go forward. You know, it's about wisdom and leadership now.
Thank you, Chris Flink, for your time, and hope to have you back again.
Hey, love to, Kojo. Enjoy your day. And anything we can do to support you and support the various nations of Africa, we're here for you.